Hello and welcome back to the Prison Officer Podcast. Before we get to our guest today, I just want to take a minute to thank one of our sponsors. During my 29 years in corrections, I've used or supervised pepperball hundreds of times. Now as a master instructor for pepperball, I get to go out across the country and teach others about the versatility and effectiveness of the pepperball system. Pepperball is always the first option in my correctional toolbox because it's got the ability to transition quickly from area saturation to direct impact, you know, using non-lethal organic projectiles. And with impact ranges from 0 to 150 feet, pepperball's perfect for cell extractions or fights out on the rec yard. To learn more about pepperball, go to www.pepperball.com or click the link below in today's show notes. Pepperball is the safer option first. And if you haven't done so, please take a moment to like my podcast, or better yet, hit that subscribe button so that you'll be notified when the next episode comes out. Well, hello and welcome back to the Prison Officer Podcast. My name is Mike Cantrell. Today's guest is Art Beeler, longtime administrator in the Bureau of Prisons. The list of things that this man has done is lengthy, and we're gonna touch on a lot of them, but he knows a lot about corrections. He's been involved with it for, I believe, over 40 years. I'll let him double check me. I'd like to welcome Art Beeler to the podcast. Welcome, Art.
Thanks, Mike. I'm glad to be here.
Absolutely. Glad we got this chance to talk. I don't know that we ever actually worked together, but I've seen a lot of your stuff on LinkedIn. And so I'm always looking at your leadership posts and stuff like that that you post. So I'm happy to have you on the podcast. If you've listened to the podcast, I usually start off the same way. I like to hear about where you came from and where you grew up, and kind of walk me through the first part of your life there before you became a correctional officer.
Thanks, Mike. I'm a Marine brat. My father was in the Marine Corps. He was a lifer. We moved from place to place all over the East Coast primarily as I was growing up. And he retired in 1969 because he was afraid he was going back to Vietnam for another time.
Okay.
And he said no. He was probably going to go for 30, but he did, and he got out, and I'm glad he did.
So he was in Korea too.
Yeah, he was in World War II, Korea and Vietnam.
Oh, my gosh. Wow. That man saw some stuff.
Yeah, he did. I wanted to go to law school. If you remember the early 90s, it was, 1970. Mm-hmm. It was not a time that things were growing. In fact, Vietnam was winding down. I went into reserves with the intention to go into Marine Corps law. Of course, the good Marine Corps dropped the program before I could get there.
Right.
So I stayed in the reserves for my 6 years. But all of a sudden, I didn't have to. But I had a good friend who was a probation officer in Eastern North Carolina.
Right.
He said, why don't you go into corrections? He said, you'll be working with the law. This won't be a lawyer. You know, his words were very true.
Yeah.
So I went to East Carolina University, in Greenville, North Carolina, which had a degree in correctional administration and social work.
Mm-hmm.
Went there and graduated from there. But before I graduated, one of the professors, a gentleman by the name of Gus Bowler, who only your oldest folks would know, came to me. He was a professor there, and he was a former deputy director of the Bureau of Prisons. And he says, how would you like, quote unquote, paid internship to go to the Federal Reformatory in Petersburg? And I heard one word, paid. I was working my way through school. So I went to Petersburg as intern. At the end of my internship, they offered me a correctional officer's job. And as they said, the rest is history.
Wow. I like the way you said it was part of the law. I think people don't think about that often. Our criminal justice system is made up of three parts, and corrections is not part of the law enforcement part. You've got the courts, you've got law enforcement, and then you've got corrections who handles the punishment part of it. So I think that's interesting that he brought that to you in that manner. So you go to Petersburg. Had you ever been in a prison before?
Just a visit tour.
Yeah, yeah. So what was that like walking in the first day? Door slams. Now you are working, even though it's an intern, you're still in there like everybody else. What'd that feel like?
Well, I can give you that. I can't tell you how many times the door has slammed since then.
Yeah.
But I can tell you that door slammed, and it was a slam because there was a grate from the door out of the administration building into the compound. And the door slammed.
Sure. Sure.
They'll remember that.
I bet. I think we all do. I think it's when it becomes real, isn't it?
Yeah.
So
the other thing I remember well is my first day in uniform after having finished my internship and became a correctional officer. My first day in uniform, they had a serious assault in one of the housing units.
Yeah.
And the lieutenant says, "Baylor, you go Ramirez, you go pick up those folks." So here we go, tromping over to the unit, and we were locking up 23 people that day.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. So did you see blood that day? Was that the first time you saw the blood, the fight, the stabbing, or whatever went on? How did that affect you?
I saw it when I was an intern. It bothered me. But it didn't, and I didn't have an issue with it because I said my job was to make sure I try to keep them alive.
Sure, sure. Yeah, absolutely part of our job. So now you're a correctional officer. Walk me through that.
Well, I became a correctional officer, and as all new correctional officers, I had all sorts of assignments. I remember my first day into a tower. Of course, all the towers are closed now, but my first day as a tower, and I said, "My God, have I got to be up here for 8 hours?" different way of the books, trying to keep stay awake at midnight in the tower. Excitement during one of my tower tours is that we had six inmates escape through a fence with a vehicle. I'll never forget that either. And I never will forget that that was on Christmas Eve. And I was supposed to go home and see my parents for the first time since I left. And my wife was there, and she was there by herself. And I called her, and I said, "I can't come home, honey." And she says, "When are you going to get home?" And I said, "I have no idea."
Right. Absolutely. So when did you start thinking about moving up in leadership? Was that?
That was pretty funny because I was hoping to come on board as a case manager.
Huh?
And when I came on board as a correctional officer, I will tell you that my wife said, "Why are you doing this?" And I said, "Because I need the job." I was still going to try to go to law school at some point in time, but I never did. And I will tell you, the 2 years I spent as a correctional officer were the most important 2 years of my career. I got to see what offenders did 3 o'clock in the morning when there were no suits in the building. There, in an old living unit, which was an open bay living unit by myself.
Sure.
Had apples and oranges thrown at me. Probably the most important, only significant thing thrown at me. And I think I remembered all sorts of stuff. But what impacted me the most was I was there for about a year, and I was on morning watch patrol. And here comes this guy lumbering in civilian clothes inside the compound. All of a sudden, "Sir, may I ask you who you are?" And he was the new warden. And he says, Mr. Beeler, why don't you show me the next 4 hours? So for 4 hours, we walked the compound. I asked him questions. He asked me questions. I still remember something I used 15 years later in our discussion. Is we had just had a bunch of folks, or had a person climb the water tower. And at that time, water towers in the compound wasn't fenced. And I said, a bunch of people wanted you to go up and get him. And you said, no, just leave him up there. When he gets cold or hungry, he'll come down.
Right.
And guess what? He did. Well, about 15 years later, I was at El Reno, Oklahoma. And we had a bunch of Cubans on the rec yard, and they refused to come in. I think there were 15 of them, and mm-hmm. they refused to come in. And I had an associate warden says, you want me to dress up the team and go in and get them, boss? And I said, nope. I want you just to put a jug of water there and leave them alone. Well, at 3 o'clock in the morning, guess what? They came cold, because I told them, don't give them any coats. Leave them just like they are. And at 3 o'clock in the morning, they called and they said,
no,
they're coming in. So that was a lesson of experience right there.
Absolutely. And I think that comes from experience is patience. We forget patience a lot. You know, we get so caught up in the now of stuff that we sometimes just back off and let things have a breath. And that could be a cell extraction. It could be all kinds of stuff, but let things have a breath sometimes is something I think it's a tool and a lesson for everybody moving up into leadership positions. Absolutely.
And it comes with maturity.
Yeah.
I mean, I used to have staff said, what are you doing? If you know me, you know that I've run mental health hospitals, two large mental health hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
I had an inmate who said, I'm not eating, I'm going on a hunger strike. I said, okay, let's go.
Right.
About
right.
Second day, I walked down there and I can't remember the guy's name. I said, what's going to stop you from being on a hunger strike? And he says, I want some ice cream. I said, okay. I went down, got him a pint of ice cream, came back, says, now, if I give this to you, you have already told me you're going to stop the hunger strike. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Gave him the ice cream. He stopped the hunger strike. You know, a lot of staff used to get up doing stuff like that. And I said, my number one job is keeping people in here and keeping you safe. If I can do something that doesn't cost me to keep you safe, I'm going to do it. And you can think what you might of me, but my job is I want to go home with my family.
Absolutely. Yeah, I worked at Springfield, so I saw a lot of the same thing, and you did have administrators, and when I was 25 years old, I wanted to run in there,
yeah.
But you did have administrators that saw the bigger vision there, which is, I'm going to have to suit up a team twice a day. This is costing money. Institutions shut down during that time. All of these factors, when you just solve this problem with a 50-cent thing of ice cream from the commissary.
You got it.
Yeah, absolutely. So where'd you go next? What was your next step up?
Well, I stayed in Pittsburgh for 4 years. My last year, almost the acting assistant almost the entire time, while holding my load, by the way. but I then put in for, I don't know how many jobs. The job I got was being witness protections caseworker in D.C. And
wow.
For a couple here, a little over a year, I dealt with all of people who were being hit out all over the country because of their testimony. And I had to learn how to work with U.S. attorney, U.S. attorney's offices, and all of them were not the same. Let me just tell you that way. it really boiled down to the reality of those. And we all working through the Office of Enforcement Operations over at Justice, but all they wanted to do is the AUSA was happy.
Right, right. Well, that sounds like a pretty cool job, but so where'd you go from there?
I became two more jobs. I became the administrator for correctional programs, or the assistant administrator, rather, for correctional programs. The largest stuff there was doing D.C. designation.
Right.
District of Columbia Superior Court designation. And I was a guy by the name of Jay Williams, who you may remember his name. I became his executive assistant.
Okay. Excellent. Yeah. So what made you want to leave D.C. and go become a warden? Well, just next step?
The reality of it is if you stayed in D.C. too long, you never got out.
Right. And
there were lots of people, lifers in D.C., and I did not want
to. Yeah.
So I went to Bill Ingram, who then the assistant director for correctional programs. And I said, Bill, I need to go back out to the field. There was a fly in the ointment in that my wife had just called, and she had serious medical post delivery. So I told Gil, I just have someplace. I'm 8 hours from here, so I can bring my wife back to the doctor when she had her doctor's appointment. And Gil was just a gentleman of a gentleman, as he always was. And he says, well, I can send you back to Petersburg as the executive. And I said, well, sounds good to me. So I went back to Petersburg as the executive assistant and / at the time case management coordinator. We went one of those times that we're trying to do three jobs in one.
Yeah. Yeah, and in charge of the camp. So,
yep.
Got yep. It. Okay. So, what was next? Warden? Where'd you go next?
I went to, where did I go next? I went to Duluth, Minnesota as the assistant superintendent. We had just opened Duluth on an Air Force base closed. We didn't open the entire base. The guard kept part of the base and we got the other part of the base. It was an interesting, all cold, very cold. We tried contract first time a couple places in there. One didn't work. Of course, being the assistant superintendent, which later became the wardens in all those places, when you became the associate warden, I had everyone under my supervision except for federal president. And so I had 13 or 14 disciplines that I was responsible for. We learned all the paper.
I missed the name. What was the name of the fort?
Duluth.
Duluth. Fort Duluth. Okay. No, you're up at Duluth.
It was Duluth Air Force Base.
Oh, okay. Okay. We, I've said on this, and you can tell me your opinion, but I've said on the podcast quite a bit. You know, there was a time when we had a lot of these camps scattered around near military bases where we took care of veterans' homes, where they went out and did the work and stuff. But the last few years, or most of the last of my career, campers are sitting in their house watching TV, and we don't have them out working like we're doing. We're not saving the federal government money the way we used to. So that's just one of the things I've been talking about. I would like to see either put a fence around it. Either they need a fence or they don't. If they need a fence, put them in behind one. If they don't, put technology on them. I'm conflicted as to why we keep some of the camps open. Since you went through part of that, do you have an opinion on that?
Well, camps on military bases themselves, and I've been at two of those, and I helped close one of them. They have a benefit on a military basis because they're all working. And, when I was at Maxwell, which was my first warden's position, we had a population of 900, and 500 of them went out to work either for the base at the air base, Air University, or there was another base about 5 miles away called Gunner Air Force Base. We had a living unit there. So those folks worked. They worked pretty hard. You know, when
there's not as many, there's not as many jobs out there for the inmates. You know, Leavenworth, our camp inmates used to take care of the fort there. But now you walk in there and there's maybe 100 out a day. So what are we doing with the rest of them? You know what I'm saying?
Good question.
But yeah. You
know, and you know, there's pros and cons. A lot of the reason we have camps is all political.
Yeah.
I mean, the bottom line is there's a lot of folks in camps that probably could be home on electronic monitoring.
Yeah. But
people don't see that as prison.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a public perception too. Absolutely. So where'd you go next? What was the next step after you were taking care of those?
I went to Lexington, Kentucky, as it's important.
Now, Lexington's one of the old institutions. Yeah. What was that like?
It was built in the 20s as a public health service hospital. Public health service gave it up in 1974, and all of a sudden we had a prison. It was a very unique place in that during my associate warden's time there, we had male and female compound at the same time. And let's just put it this way. I learned a whole lot about how strong the sexual urge is when I was at Lexington.
I knew a food service administrator that worked there then, and he said it was just constant keeping your eyes on them.
You know, it. We were, at that time, a very strong commission, but we were not a medical service. I went there as associate warden. But it was an old institution that always required everything. And it was a big, big grounds institution. We had to keep going. So we did not have a camp. So we kept the outside running through gate passes. We would have about 100 inmates go out the back gate every day to cut grass in the wintertime. Shovel snow or ice or whatever was there. And it was I was both AWO and AWP. While I was there. So it was an interesting time.
Yeah. Yeah. So what was your first warden? Where'd you go to for that?
My first wardenship was at Maxwell, Montgomery, Alabama.
Oh, okay.
The camp.
And then where'd you go from there?
Now you're going to have to.
Okay. How many places have you been to? Cause it's a bunch.
Yeah. I got out of the sweetest job I ever had. I always tell people, they ask me, well, what was it like at Maxwell? I said, well, we rebuilt the whole camp with inmate labor, which we did that year I was there. But the hardest decision I had to make is whether to serve French toast or pancakes on Friday morning.
Whichever one kept them working, huh?
Yeah. It wasn't that simple, but that's what I used to tell people. Yeah. But I left Maxwell and I went to Chicago. And that was like going into the fire frying pan, running a jail area. I got most of my information not from pre-sentence investigation or from the probation office. I got it from reading the Chicago Tribune and the Chicago Sun-Times. because it would tell me about the inmates if they were serious inmates, meaning with any sort of history, we would go from the papers. It's where I got my real appreciation of gangs. We had the El Rucan there who were fighting for Chicago.
Yep.
By the name of Jim Port. Wasn't a nice guy. I don't know where he is. I hope he's met his match, but the kicker is that we had gangs there. We had U.S. attorney who would like to keep their inmates there forever. And of course, our job was to get them around. But like keep them there forever. And people who didn't, I always thought we worked for the same attorney general until I got to Chicago and all of a sudden I found out that our role and our mission was not the same role and mission of the Marshal Service or the U.S. Attorney's Office. And the job was to work with everybody.
So you mentioned earlier that you've taken care of two federal medical centers. And I worked at a medical center, and I know how big a job that is, but I have no idea how big a job that is as a warden. Talk to me a little bit about those two medical centers.
Well, when I finished up at Chicago, and I went back to in the central office, I went back to work Lexington again as the warden. By that time, federal medical center. And the women were leaving. It had gone to all females. The women were leaving and going to Caswell. And so I had to do a mission at Lexington. That was geriatrics. And, you know, I have a great amount of admiration for the executive staff during that time because they realized we need a place. They realized we needed a place for geriatric inmates.
Yeah.
Quite frankly, we probably need more than one now. But I don't know. I'm not there anymore. But we opened up as a geriatric facility for male inmates. People would say, well, that's easy. They're not going to cause problems. And they did cause problems in the routine way. They were getting some fights and some abortion stuff. But they really didn't get in trouble. Where they got in trouble is you had to try to talk them into medical stuff. You couldn't get them sometimes. They didn't want to do what they wanted to do. They're all over the place.
Right. Yeah, a lot of people don't understand how hard it is. I mean, it's one thing to deal with an inmate who may have a propensity for violence, but then when they get older, now they've got dementia or they've got Alzheimer's, and those are some of the most difficult inmates I ever dealt with.
Yeah, I can still name the one. I won't, but I can say about 10 of them that I know on the top of my head that, you know, why were we keeping them? And I asked that question reportedly a couple of times and got told one time to sit up and be quiet.
Well, and there's many sides to that too, because we have social workers in the Bureau of Prisons, as you know, and placement of some of those guys, it's the greater, the greater community, the public almost would rather keep them there than to send this person where, a nursing home where you've got your grandmother and grandfather. So I don't know. We have a lot of places there where we can accept those challenges and make some changes. And geriatrics has grown since then. The prison population is getting old and they're living longer and we're taking better care of them. So we've got guys, with long sentences up into their 70s, 80s, 90s.
One thing that I don't think, and this isn't talking about the system, I'm talking about the industry as itself. I don't think we've done a good job of planning for what's coming around the corner and going to hit us. And that's all these folks that are chronologically 15 years older than their biological. All of a sudden, you've got somebody who's 60 years old and has had a stroke. Nobody knows what to do with it. So you do the best you can with them. You develop programs, have inmate companions, roll them around the institution, which it has good points, bad points. You have people take them to dinner. You have inmates. We call the companion program at Butner when I was at Butner. We had one at Lexington too, but it wasn't as active. And we had a companion program that stayed with them while they were dying.
Because
oftentimes they're giving them up.
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned Butner there. That's a huge institution, especially now. When you took over Butner, what was it like then? And what did you see while you were there?
I started Butner, was destined to open a medical center that has been grown from the ground. Since Springfield was open in 1933.
Right.
So we were building the institution. and do it as frugally as we could. And so we didn't get everything to start with, but there were three things we did from day one. One is we had a large mental health contingent. We got a lot of those inmates, FCI, Correctional Institution 1. Then we got oncology service, and we to take care of all the oncologists in the Bureau of Prisons when they were identified and sent to us. And then we had a very small right. So we had lots of different variations there. You know, you had to get, number one is that you had to make sure that staff who were working mental health, you'll appreciate that having worked there at Springfield, we had to teach them how to deal with mental health. We had to teach them how to attempt to de-escalate situations. We had to teach them that going in probably was not the way to deal with those people most of the time. There's a time and place for everything, but most of the time you didn't go in on my game. You tried to make sure that you had some what I called old heads back in mental health that knew how to talk to folks, and even schizophrenics and schizoaffective disorder. They had a rapport, and most of the time, 99% of them, they would have the situation handled. And, you know, along with good psychologists and psychiatrists, we were able, in most occasions, to deal with those folks. Now, that's not an always. I remember a schoolmate that was that way for 7 years. Tried everything we could try. Still didn't work. Still with schizophrenia. I left tired. And, you know, most of the time we could find the right, not we, doctors could find the right combination of medicines and get the person to be a little better. You know, Butner was a place where we also took all high security healthcare cases along with Springfield. And, you know, I've had a lot of terrorists and a lot of bombers and all those kind of there. And, you know, you have to be able to run a high security institution inside of a hospital. And that was the challenge.
Yeah, absolutely. I know sometimes they'd send one to Springfield or Butner, and, you know, it'd wear the staff down after a while with some of those high profile of those terrorists. So, you know, we'd switch them out just to have a break after a couple of years of, you know, 2-3 times a day dealing with that same inmate that's uncontrollable and whatever.
Same. We try to work with them for a while. We try to rotate them out just to give staff a break.
Yeah.
I mean, I had a good relationship with the union on this part of my tenure. Was that I've had people who came to me and said, "Warden, I can't work here anymore. It's too depressing." Yeah. It's all those kind of things. And, you know, luckily we had 4 institutions camp at Butner. I call it 5 institutions. Yeah. So I would be able to typically find that person on the compound or right there in the institution and let them stay. But people don't realize that the toll, you know, everybody talks about prison, and I've worked in prisons, of course, but everybody talks about the toll of prisons on staff. And one of those tolls is the way they have to manage with people who are very sick or very mentally ill.
Sure. I think one of the unrecognized heroes of medical centers, especially, are the nurses. Because in order to be a nurse, you have to have a certain amount of empathy. And then you walk in a prison, and now I have to take that empathy, but I have to put it with, you know, concern and security and all, everything else that goes with it. And some of the nurses I felt the sorriest for were the dialysis nurses, because you're going to see that same inmate three times a week. There's right. no way to get a break, you know? Yeah. So well,
I will tell you what some people call a funny story, but when we got brand new, a lot of new nurses opened Butner, and when I got a new nurse, they would go through inmate familiarization, and I always tried to not inmate familiarization, excuse me, IF.
Right.
But when they went
institutional.
Through, yeah, institutional familiarization. One of my second books was I would teach, look at the nurses, and I said, I want to teach you how to have contact with your inmates. Mm-hmm. And most of the other people looked at me like I was crazy again. Mm-hmm. I got called out. But I would go, I would show, grab his elbow with your hand. And nobody's going to see that as a sexual innuendo of any kind or not. Sure. But if you have to show that you tell the inmate you grab his elbow to tell him that you care for him, but don't do anything else.
Right.
And it worked.
Sure. Sure. Absolutely. So, You retired. Tell me about when did you retire? 2009? Is that right?
2009.
So
basically got kicked out. I would have been able to stay for about six more months, but my tax consultant told me to get out at the first of the year. So got out. And,
well,
assessment after being a warden at however many places I was a warden at seven places and became complex warden. And so I added some more institutions. The complex warden, all of a sudden you go out and you're Joe Nobody again.
Right. So you retired apparently back to North Carolina, but you didn't slow down any, did you?
Not a whole lot.
Tell me a little bit about what you've been doing.
Well, went to Afghanistan for a year, not because I up because I got called, asked if I would go to, and I did. And from everything I told my dad after it, things hadn't changed a lot.
Yeah,
the State Department wanted, and the Defense Department wanted, and guess what? I was stuck in the middle because I was a State Department consultant assigned to a JTF, which is a joint task force. Whose whole job was the military. So,
what they have you consulting about mostly?
Well, I was supposed to be the rule of law consultant, okay? What I ended up being a report writer for the three-star admiral that I worked for.
Yeah. The way that works sometimes, isn't it?
Yeah. And so, you know, they asked me if I would ever come back. I said, not unless I love them.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you've been doing a lot of auditing. I see that.
I audit for the American Correctional Association. I've audited a couple of things too, but primarily I've audited for ACA. I've done that. I did that even before prisons, but then legal said it was a conflict of interest. So, we stopped it and we went back, and I've been doing it since then.
Right.
I don't do a lot more. I do five or six a year. There are people who audit all the time. But no, yeah. I enjoy auditing. Number one, it keeps me in the business. Number two is I find new things that make sense and I can swipe in somebody else. And number three, it's nice. You don't think this is crazy. It's nice to see an inmate, everyone.
I actually understand all that more than you think. I went to work for Pepperball after I retired, so I still get to go into prisons and jails, and I get to talk to the staff, and I get to, you know, walk through the housing units, and I get to smell food service, you know.
Yeah.
And it's weird, but it's almost comforting after doing it for so long.
It is.
So with you being a PREA coordinator, just a couple of minutes here, but that's so important, and I tried to cover it a little bit on one episode, but if you're talking to an employee who's got a few years in, What's some of the big takeaways that you're seeing or that you come across, things that you're running across that need to be fixed, that type of stuff? What would you say to them?
Well, most of the time, line staff just say, okay, this is another requirement. We've got to do the work here. Now, I'm a big believer, and I'm going to go through the whole thing one second, because it puts sexual violence and says we're not going to have
it. Right.
I'm all for that. I even taught PREA for a year to new PREA auditors. But for about 5 years now, I guess, I haven't been doing PREA.
Okay.
It's not that I don't believe in the process. It's that I could no longer work for them when they weren't being flexible in regards to what I call the traumatization of women going to have to work inside of institutions when mm-hmm. you had to announce yourself. And you say, women on the unit, and especially in high security institutions, every doggone person who had nothing to lose was sitting there masturbating in front of the staff member.
Right.
And I went to the PREA folks and I said, you know, we got to figure out how to do it. And they said, well, you can write up a report. And I said, you think that for somebody who was serving 25 years in prison, an incident report's going to do anything? So you put them in SEG for 30 days. It's not going to do a thing in the world. Especially if they were mentally ill, a number of them were. But we got to figure out how to do that differently. And they said no. I said, well, I've got three artists in it. It's a principal decision. Is that I work too hard and too long to get females to work inside of prison. I remember when there weren't females inside of prison working inside the wall. They have normalized a lot of things, and they've made prisons safer. So if you're not going to figure out how to protect the women a little bit, then I'm not going to do audits anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. I worked 1992. I came into Missouri State Pen, which was a very old prison. Still a lot of bad things going on there. I saw prison rape. I saw the effects of prison rape on inmates there. So absolutely PREA was needed. It was something that needed to be brought to attention and so that we could deal with it. But I'm kind of like you, the last few years, it's the unintended consequences of it. We've just overdone it to where it's not useful anymore. I've got staff. I had staff when I was opening up a new institution that were just absolutely petrified to put hands on an inmate.
Right.
We can't run institutions without putting hands on inmate, you know? I had a warden tell me, and he was, did a great job because I told him I was having this problem. He says, here's what you do. You're the captain. You go down there to, A&O and you pick out the biggest inmate sitting in A&O and you pull him up front and you say, this is what a pat search looks like here in front of everybody. And then there's no question from that point on how we do pat searches. And that stopped a lot of it because the inmates weren't able to buffalo the staff with, hey, you're not supposed to do that. No, this is what the captain does.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's a lot of unintended consequences that came with that.
And there's a lot of people who are very scared of a PREA case on it.
Yeah.
I was consulting in North Carolina. They were getting ready for an ADA audit, and they had a gang shower. It's an old facility, and they had a gang shower, and the inmates had the tendency, let's put it that way, to take a sheet or a blanket and hang it up over there so you couldn't see in.
Right.
And there's a male institution, and I walked in, and said, I'm going to file PREA on you. I'm in here. I'm taking a shower, and I said, you do what you have to do. My job is to make sure you're okay. And so, yeah, I went in. I've had a couple of cases on me.
Sure.
So that's just part of the job.
Yeah.
But we have staff. And in North Carolina, we had this guy was, I remember this associate warden saying, you can't go down there. I said, why not? I have myself, we don't want you going down there. And I had a warden who said, I was consulting at one of the hospitals, and the warden said, we would prefer you not going down there by yourself. And I said, okay. I said, I'm a consultant. I will do what you asked me to do, but it's not right.
Right. Yeah. A lot of it is just knowledge. Knowledge is power. The more you know and understand the process, the more you can walk within that process without worry and fear. You know, once I became knowledgeable about Priya, I'm like you. It didn't bother me to go anywhere. It didn't bother me for an inmate to come up and say, well, you're not supposed to do that. Well, yes, I am. This is what policy says. This is what Priya says. This all falls within it. So that's what I would say to everybody. Get knowledgeable. If you're having concerns, if you've got fear about working with inside of Priya, get knowledgeable about it. And that solves a lot of that.
I agree wholeheartedly. You know, it's tough.
It is. It's a tough situation. It's needed, but at the same time, it's being kind of messed with. So,
what I told the Priya folks in D.C., I said, told them that you've got to be pragmatic. You want to do the job, but you cannot make the job so undesirable for staff. I want to do it.
Sure. Absolutely. So we talked the other day for just a minute, and we were talking about, you know, a couple of things that we could talk about on here. And one of the things you mentioned was the problem with staffing right now. You said that was one of the things that you're seeing. And of course, I mean, we're talking about it all over the place, but tell me what you're seeing in the positions you're in with understaffing and how that's affecting corrections.
Well, you know, there's a whole mindset. Now, when I started, which was almost 50 years ago, but corrections was seen as a desirable job.
Yeah.
For a lot of people, it was how they got their benefit. And they would work another job secondary. Well, most of that's gone away. And so people are working in prison it's just not the same. We have more females working in prison now than we probably ever had.
Sure.
I think, all that has happened. That's not the reason we have understaffing. We have understaffing because we have not told staff and publicly, in my view, how important they are. I don't mean the warden getting and saying, you're very important. I mean the government and saying we have to have correctional officers. They do a good job. They're just like police. And what I equate this to, we're just like police officers.
Mm-hmm.
We're just inside the fence.
Sure.
The only difference is we get to know the people a lot better because we've got a benefit for 15 or 20 years. And I have very good friends who are police officers. And they would tell me, I could not have your job because I arrest them, I arraign them, you guys take them, put them in jail, and the only other time I ever see them is on court dates.
Right.
Unless they're released. And I said, yeah, not the way you have to work inside the position.
Yeah.
You have to develop your behavior, science is skills to be able to learn how to talk with people and not to people. You have to learn how to manage them as people and respect them as people and a whole different mindset. And most people think we're either overblown social workers or knuckle draggers. And we're neither. Huh. We're probably in the middle. And that's how you tell people, if I have to have use for it, I'll use for it. It's not something that I cherish doing because what happens more times than not, staff get hurt. But I have this force, and you have to talk to that inmate that night in a compassionate way because his father did not. We do that too.
Sure.
We have to go on both ends, and we have to be able to go on both ends of the spectrum. I said, that's a difficult thing to do. And I tell you, good correctional officers do that day in and day
out. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right about it's got to change that, you know, corrections is talking about short staffing. The country has to talk about short staffing. This isn't a corrections problem. Just like we talked about earlier, there's three tiers, you know, to our justice system. The courts, the law enforcement, and corrections. If one of those fails, the justice system fails. So it's not about keeping or letting corrections fail. If that happens, the whole justice system's fail.
That's correct.
And so what are some of the stuff? I mean, you've been around a long time. And you talked about it's not just about, you know, telling them good job. A lot of, excuse me, you see a lot of memes on the computer, you know, another pizza party. It's not about pizza parties anymore. We've got to tell these officers and show the world what's going on and how good a job they do and how important they are. How do we do that?
Well, we haven't done very well. I include myself in that. Is we got to go out and press the button in the city. We have to go talk to them. We have to get on their agenda. We have to tell them these people are important. They're doing an important job. And you could, and society would hurt tremendously if they weren't out there doing their job. I try to do that every time I get a chance to do that. But I think every warden, every associate warden needs to be out in their communities pressing the flesh. And then they're surrounded by pressing the flesh. You know, we still have a lot of institutions that the biggest employer in the county is that prison that's sitting there. But they don't want to hear from us unless there's a problem. I think we have to go before the problem and tell them that this is what's happening and this is what's going on.
Yeah, there's prison and corrections culture has such a long history of keeping everything inside the fence and being quiet about it. And there's two parts to that. One is corrections didn't want people digging into their dirty business or what went on. And the other one is, I think every time people see corrections out in public, we remind them that the boogeyman's out there, you know, and he lives behind that fence. So they just as well forget about it also. Now I have seen in this podcast as an example, you know, there's four or five of us podcasts going now about corrections, which you wouldn't have seen 10 years ago. No. There was maybe a book once in a while. So, if we can talk about this, if we can get it out there, if administrators will start sharing, not only when something bad happens with staff, which is the only time we hit the news, but make it a bigger thing when the good is done. When an officer, I mean, in my career, I've probably saved two or three lives during suicides, attempted suicides.
Sure.
You know, but that was just, oh, okay, clean off the blood, you know, go back to your housing unit and come back to work the next day. We've got to, I don't know, make that a bigger part of who we are.
We have got to make sure that the public understands how valuable it is. They don't really get it. That's prison. And as long as they're inside and no riot, nobody's getting hurt, that's the only thing they care about.
Well, true.
We got to go out and tell people why prisons do that and how prisons do that and why they don't have, comparatively, and why they don't have many riots comparatively.
Oh, yeah.
We got to go out and tell these people. And usually, hard to get on somebody, but you got to keep on trying, because the agenda that people want to hear about is, what was this like on this day when you hit Y and Z? Well, it's not fun, but you the issue is that you got to keep on trying, because the public has got to get to the point that they agree that this is an important thing.
Yeah, it's important, it's necessary. And there's some, and I say this over and over again, there's some extremely amazing people that work behind those fences and walls that nobody ever sees. Yeah. Worked with a bunch of them.
Me too.
And I'm learning with this podcast that's worldwide. And I didn't notice that until I started this podcast. But there's great people working behind walls all over the world doing the same job I did for almost 30 years.
Yeah. And that's, when I go out in my office, the one thing I get to see in different jurisdictions is maybe they've done something better than I've seen before. But what you get to see is the dedication of the people who are out there. Yeah. And what they do, and you know, the nurses and the mechanical services and the food service foreman, just the officers. I mean, it's all over the institution where they are showing themselves as wonderful, wonderful people.
Yeah.
I always think of amazing folks. I think about the assistant director of nurses. I think about the psychologist who spent Thanksgiving with me one year because we had a person who was swallowing bed springs when we had bed springs. Mm-hmm. I think about all these people who just do things people just would not even understand that they're doing it, and they're doing it for one or two reasons. They're doing it to keep the institution calm, or they're doing it because they have a desire to make sure people, even inmates, quote unquote, but people go home safe.
Sure. Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So, well, what are you doing now? What, you got any projects going right now?
Well, I teach a little bit. I'm teaching a graduate course program evaluation, and I keep just shaking my head because the stuff that we do with correctional officers, they have never been taught. And so my job some of the time is to give them a fast lesson on why they're important. I don't think it makes a difference, but I do it anyway. I volunteer with a couple of pro bono groups that do reentry. I work with a pro bono group that wants to make prisons safer. And I work with a statewide commissioner with Indigent Defense Service. And people say, why are you working with them? Those are lawyers. I say, yes, but everybody deserves hope.
Yeah.
And you
absolutely.
Know, one of the things I always said is to a guy who was writing me up or writing a BP-9, I would said I'd much rather them write me up than come in with me with a knife and try to get to me. Let them have it. Let him write it. If we think we're wrong, we tell him and we give him, we say, yeah, you're right, we're wrong.
Yeah.
Nothing. There's no shame.
No.
The bottom line is that you got to show these people that you're going to respect. You got to show the return that you're going to respect them.
Yeah.
You've got to try to help them. You know, our recidivism rate is absolutely terrible in this country. And I don't think everybody who leaves prison is wanting to come back to prison. In fact, I don't want to come back. Truth, but we don't make it easier on returning citizens. Mm-hmm. In North Carolina, for example, they give them $45 gate money, and that's it.
Yep.
That's it. And it, you know, there's very few transitional houses in North Carolina, so most of these people just go home. And I said, folks, right. I go to dinner with my wife, costs more than $5.
Sure.
How do we expect these folks to make it, especially since typically, not always, but or they haven't saved any. There's no way for them. There's very few opportunities for them to save money. Yeah. And they're going back to a grandma or grandpapa or father and mother and who really can't afford them.
Yeah.
And so what happens when the kid, most of them have children, and they have a child, and all of a sudden, they get a bill for $3,000. Johnny needs a break. And you know, he doesn't have health insurance. Not that health insurance pays all that. And the guy says, okay, let me go back and do what I'm good at doing. And yeah. he goes, sells a cube of drugs. Now, do I condone that? Absolutely not. Do I understand it better now than I ever before? We've got to figure out, you're talking about why we need to do for correctional officers. We got to figure out ways how to keep these people out of the community because they cost a lot of money.
Sure.
You know, corrections was $8.1 billion last year or something like that.
Yeah, I know. It's crazy. On the insurance thing, and I'm just, I interviewed Percy Pitzer a few episodes ago.
Yeah,
He's working with a company who's providing insurance for these guys when they're first getting out. So, yeah, I mean, stuff like that, if we could expand that, and you're right. I don't know how many people I walked out and you give them that last check and it's what's on their commissary and say, don't come back. A rent costs $800 minimum somewhere. And then right. you got to have first and last for water and you got to set this up. And a lot of times we are setting up for failure as a society. And it's too bad.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know where it was. There was some state recently that the legislature passed that inmates would get $2,500 and the governor vetoed. And I'm sitting there saying, you know, that would have been a perfect case study to see how many of these folks made it when they got $2,500 versus the $100 that they used to.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. We got a lot of stuff to work on.
We do.
We always have.
Always will.
Always will. Hey, if somebody wants to contact you, do you have an email or something?
Sure. My email is afejab@aol.com.
Okay. I'll go ahead and put that in the staff or in the show notes if anybody wants to reach out to you and follow up. But I sure thank you, Art, for being on here. I appreciate the conversation. I think people really enjoy hearing not only your experience, but some of your thoughts after 40 years. How many years is it total?
Well, it'll be 49 years this year.
49 years.
So. Can I say just one other thing?
Sure.
And that is to anyone who's listening to this, never forget your staff.
Mm-hmm.
We say that all the time. But from the bottom of my heart, the only reason I was successful was because I had staff who supported me.
Yeah.
It was not me. I'm just a dumb old country boy from Eastern North Carolina. But it was because my staff supported me.
Yeah.
My staff, for the most part, after I became a warden, it took me a little while to figure out that I wasn't on Mintman at that time, too. But they would tell me when I was full of crap, and that was very valuable.
Yep.
And they would give me ideas on what they needed. It was very valuable. But never, ever, ever think that you are important if you're an associate warden or a warden. You have a title, but you're not important. Those people out there working the trenches are important. Thank you, Mike.
Absolutely. I'm going to follow up just a little bit. So I sat down last night and I had been watching part of Band of Brothers. And there's that section in there where Buck has been gambling with the NCOs. And Dick Winters tells him, you know, you can't do that. And he goes, why? And he said, what if you'd won? You should never put yourself in a position that they owe you. You always owe them.
Amen.
And that was a good reminder. To hear that last night. So I think we can all live by that.
And you're exactly right.
Thank you so much, Art. I hope you have a great day.
Thank you so much, sir.
Well, thanks for listening today. And before we go, I'd like to take a minute to thank one of our sponsors. Omni Real-Time Locating System is a company that I've been working closely with for the last couple of years. I'm proud to be part of this innovative team that has developed the best real-time locating system on the market for your jail or prison. Omni's PREA-compliant real-time monitoring technology is the very best way to track and record the locations and interactions of all the inmates and assets throughout every square inch of your facility. Imagine getting an alarm the second an escape happens. or being able to send a medical response the second an inmate's heart rate drops below a defined level. To learn more about Omni, go to www.omnirtls.com or click the link below in today's show notes. Omni Real-Time Locating System is a powerful tool designed specifically for the modern correctional professional. If you haven't done so, please take a moment to like my podcast, or better yet, hit that subscribe button. Thanks for listening, and be safe out there.